Hello, you're listening to The Music Mill, and I'm Mark Thompson here with you for the next hour. Coming up in the next half hour, I'll be speaking to journalist Joe Fidgin, who has recently been researching the ethics of meat eating. Now, I'll confess that I'm a dedicated carnivore myself, but I have to admit that whenever I think too deeply about the subject, I do get a little bit uncomfortable. I mean, I consider myself an animal lover, and yet I have no problem tucking into steak, pork chops, and especially bacon. Am I a total hypocrite? Well, we'll see what Joe thinks in a few minutes. Then later we'll be joined by comedian Wendy Wason, who will be discussing all the different roles she's had to fulfil in her life, wife, mother, daughter, friend, etc., and whether there's any room left for herself at the end of it all. I'm very interested in this, as when I totted them up, I fulfil about 10 different roles in my life, and I'm not entirely sure which one is the real me, or even if the real me is an actual thing. Maybe we'll find out later.
Contact Mark now. Tweet at Mark Reckons.
And the first thing we're going to talk about is the subject of meat eating. So I'm a carnivore, as I mentioned earlier, and I like nothing better than tucking into a steak or a nice piece of bacon. But I listened to a radio show on BBC Radio 4 last week, Analysis. Well, I actually listened to it as a podcast walking my dog around my field. I must say I started to feel a little bit guilty because I realised I don't generally really think about the ethics of meat eating. I consider myself an animal lover. But really, am I a total hypocrite? Well, I'm joined by Joe Fidgin, who is the presenter of Analysis, presenter of the show that was on last week. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
Good to have you on.
Thank you. Good to be here.
For the benefit of anyone who didn't hear the show, do you want to just outline what motivated you to make it in the first place?
Well, so I started to care more about animal suffering a while ago and started rethinking how I buy meat. So I was on a farm on holiday, and it's only a small holding. I've got a few cows and a few sheep, and it is really idyllic. So they sell a bullock or two a year in quarters for meat. And I thought, that sounds good. I know this animal's been happy. I'll have some of that. So I ordered a quarter of a bullock for the following year. And then, purely by coincidence, a couple of people at work, Lucy, who produced the programme, and Hugh, who edited it, were thinking about this issue. And Hugh was very bugged by this idea that we all talk about animal cruelty and animal suffering, and we take so much care about how we buy our meat these days, and yet, when it comes down to it, we're happy to kill it and eat it. And he thought there was an inconsistency here. So he asked me if I'd be interested in working on this programme, and I actually wasn't at all, because I didn't really want to think about whether it's okay to eat meat or not. I like eating meat, and I didn't really want to engage with this question. Anyway, he persuaded me. So I went down to meet this cow, the specific cow that was going to be killed at the beginning of the production process, and then in the middle I spoke to lots of philosophers about this question, purely about the killing of the animal. We're not engaging with the question of the suffering, because I think a lot of people think animal suffering is bad. It's purely, is it okay to kill this animal to eat it? And then 3 weeks later, at the end of the production process, went back to pick up the meat of this cow and then faced the dilemma of whether to eat it or not. A thought process I'd gone through over a few weeks and changed my view on, actually.
So in what way did you change your view?
I hadn't been persuaded by all the arguments of the philosophers, but one or two had really got to me. And it's not that I'm vegetarian all of a sudden, but I am going to eat this cow that is in my freezer. But when I eat it, I'm going to thank this cow for having given up its life to make my mealtimes a bit tastier. But I think once that cow is gone, I don't think I'll be eating any animal that I think has a mental life after that. So at the moment I'm down to rabbits. I think anything smaller than a rabbit I'm okay with, but pigs are out, unfortunately, because they're just too bright. They've got too much going on in their heads. Cows, I think, probably too. Deer are out. Yeah, I'm down to small animals and fish.
Yeah, because there was one of the people that you interviewed for the show actually has come to the conclusion that the only creature he was willing to eat was shrimps and prawns, because he'd been through a similar process to you, but his cut-off was at a different point.
Yeah, he had a very fun reason, actually, for eating only shrimps and prawns. He had read this research, because he takes this whole question very seriously. I mean, it's his business. He's a moral philosopher and thinks a lot about the ethics of death and killing. And so he actually looks at what the psychologist, the animal psychologist, is saying about what's going on in animals' head. And houseflies, apparently, they can be grooming, and you can pluck their legs off, and they don't stop grooming. They are completely unaware of themselves, it seems. And apparently, prawns, according to Jeff McMahon, this philosopher, prawns have no more mental life than that. So he's prepared to eat a creature which has no self-awareness. But he said, you know, if I find out that prawns are actually more complex, I'll stop eating them as well. And there's somebody in the program who says, wherever you draw that line, and all of them draw it in a different place, draw it in pencil, because the more we find out about animals, the more complex the issue becomes, if you want to consider it as a moral question at all. And of course, a lot of people don't.
I mean, that is interesting, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, if you think about all the things that we do consider ethically, it was very interesting for me. It was about a year or two ago, I was listening to another radio show, and it was all about, I think it was about, like, ethics of the past. So they were talking about, like, the slave trade and women's rights and all things like that, that 100, 200, 300 years ago, the zeitgeist, you know, the kind of the popular opinion about those things were very, very different to now. I mean, we look back at slavery and the fact that women couldn't vote and weren't even allowed to do certain jobs and so forth. And we look back on that as kind of the dark ages, and, you know, we find it very difficult to relate to those sort of times, or at least most people nowadays find it very difficult to relate to those times. There may be the odd person who, you know, who still wishes that women didn't have the vote and so forth, but they're in a very, very small minority these days. I think he was a philosopher and an ethicist. He was asked, in, say, 100 or 200 years' time, what are people of the future going to look back on from today and are going to look back on with abhorrence and won't be able to believe that people of our time did something? And without missing a beat, he said, eating meat. And I found that quite fascinating, because my immediate response wasn't denial. It wasn't, oh, no, don't be so ridiculous, and then go off to have a bacon sandwich. It was, do you know what? I bet he's right, actually, because it's very, very difficult to justify. When you sit down and start thinking about it, the animals are killed, and then we eat their flesh. We cook, we burn their flesh, we cook it, and we eat it. And, you know, I understand why people don't really want to think about that, because it's a horrible thing to think about when you think about it in those terms. But it's just so normal, and it's, what is it, 70-80% of people in this country are carnivorous and not vegetarian.
Yeah.
It's by far and away the most common thing. It's the norm. And it's difficult for me to understand, to really think about how that, say, 10, 15, 20% of people who are vegetarian are going to become 30, 40, 50, 60%. And there's also kind of political questions here, because you almost end up in a kind of tyranny of the majority situation, where if, let's say, 51, 52, 55% of people were vegetarian, are they going to start putting pressure on all the people who do eat meat to not?
Well, who knows? But I think slavery is a really interesting comparison, because, like you say, it's not that long ago that everyone considered it totally normal and not really a moral question at all. It just wasn't discussed. But the moment you raise it as a moral question, I think it becomes inevitable that at some point you're all going to say, this is no longer acceptable. Although there were very strong arguments that the reason the slave trade ended was for economic reasons rather than moral reasons, but nevertheless the morality has shifted to such a degree, like you say, to the point where we can no longer understand how people even thought that way. And, you know, the rights that used to belong only to landowning men then expanded to women, to children, to slaves. And that ever-expanding circle, I think, possibly will come to include some animals, certainly primates and possibly the large mammals as well. But there is a counter-argument to all of this, which raises some very interesting questions, I think, which is this idea that things like animals like cows — this isn't true of all the animals we eat, but it's true of cows — they wouldn't exist if we didn't eat them. So if we all decided to become vegetarian and stop eating cows, there wouldn't be any. I mean, you might have a few in a zoo, but the countryside would change, the environment would change, farming practices would change, not necessarily for the better, and there wouldn't be any cows. And then you get into this kind of bizarre but interesting philosophical territory about whether it's better for a cow to exist and be killed or never to exist at all. And there is a very sharp split in the literature at that point.
Yeah, because you covered that in quite a lot of detail in the programme, and I did find that aspect of it fascinating, because precisely as you say, I mean, you do have this situation. I don't know how many cows there are in the United Kingdom, but it must be many millions. I mean, I live in the countryside. I drive past fields of cows every day. You know, there must be many, many millions. And yet, as you rightly point out, they're only really there because we're going to eat them. I mean, you know, maybe there'd be a few wild cows as well, and maybe you'd get the odd... you know, enthusiast who really likes cows and would just keep them. You know, maybe there'd be a few kept for milk and so forth as well. But
it's hard to imagine how a wild cow would behave. They seem so unwild. I also live in the countryside and moved there quite recently, and see a lot of cows around, and started thinking about cows. And initially I'm just thinking, oh, you know, don't they look lovely to have them around? And then I'm thinking, don't I like to eat them? But over the last few weeks, since getting involved with this programme, I now look at them and picture them as meat on legs, which is basically what they are for us. And it is quite an odd feeling to know that something that you associate so strongly with a sort of bucolic idyll is there to be slaughtered. So it looks lovely now, but at one point it is going off to the abattoir and it will turn up on someone's plate. And it's not a very nice feeling, I have to say.
No, and it's interesting as well that, I mean... It's not like we eat all animals. I mean, you mentioned primates, but you know, I don't know anyone who's ever eaten a primate. And there are other animals as well that we seem to put in a special category. Horses, for example. I mean, certainly in the United Kingdom, eating horse is not considered the right thing to do at all. And there was that scandal a couple of years ago, wasn't there, when horse appeared to accidentally have found its way into millions and millions of pre-prepared meals, and people were quite horrified
but
by that.
But what is that about? Why are people horrified? I mean, dogs, I think, are interesting because, you know, we all keep them, a lot of us keep them as pets, and we love our dogs, and they're part of our families. And then at the other end, you've got, you know, the farm animals that we don't particularly engage with. And then horses seem to occupy this mid-territory. But when you ask people, well, what have you got against eating horse? After all, they eat it just across the channel. The only answer I've had back is, yeah, they're beautiful, aren't they? Which seems to me quite a bad criterion for deciding what you're going to eat and what you're not going to eat.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of the same sort of thing with seals, you know, that, and animals like that, animals that look very, very beautiful, that have big eyes, that almost look like baby children in a way, or remind people of baby children, then suddenly it's completely off limits. But, I mean, you know, I kind of highlighted at the start that maybe I'm being hypocritical because I'm talking about this and I'm engaging with the discussion, and yet, you know, I eat meat. I mean, there are practical problems as well, aren't there, in terms of stopping eating meat? I mean, I've known a few people... I still know a few people who are vegetarian. You know, they have to do things like they have to take supplements, and you know, one of my problems would be I don't particularly like vegetables. So the idea that I'm just going to have a plate full of vegetables and pulses would be a problem for me. But
what you've got to weigh up, I suppose, and look, I'm not advocating vegetarianism or meat eating, but how much pleasure do you get from? It's not just the pleasure from your meal. Say you have a beef curry or something. It's not just the pleasure that you get from the curry, it's that you have to weigh up against the pleasure that that cow would have got from living. It's specifically the pleasure that you get from the beef in that curry. And when you start sort of narrowing it down like that, thinking, oh, well, I get X amount of pleasure for 5 minutes a day versus the 30 extra years that that cow would have lived, it's quite an uncomfortable feeling, because I've thought of cows at 30 months for post-BSE, and naturally, they'd live to 30, 35 years. So you're taking off 3 decades of a cow's life by eating it in most instances. And then, and yeah, as I say, I'm still eating this cow that's in my freezer. I'm really not evangelizing here, but you're weighing up 30 years of cow pleasure versus however many people get to eat that particular cow for a few meals. It's quite an uncomfortable equation.
The maths don't really seem to favour carnivores at that point, do they? Because, I mean, I don't know how many curries you'd get out of a cow. Let's say it's 100. So 100 people eating a curry, but it's not just the curry, it's, you know, the beef in the curry. So maybe it improves it by 20%, let's say, or 30%, rather than if it was all lentils or vegetables.
And then you've got to calculate, well, how much pleasure does a cow get out of its life of mainly eating grass versus, you know...
That's the tricky thing, isn't it? Because to us, cows seem pretty stupid and they just stand around in a field all day and they don't really seem to do very much. It's very difficult for human beings to get into the headspace of a cow, isn't it? But I suppose that's quite arrogant, really, because just because, you know, we're more advanced and we'll, you know, do things like play on PlayStations and so forth doesn't necessarily mean that their life isn't still worth living, does it?
Well, one of the things that I was thinking about during this programme is that how much we privilege language. So if an animal can communicate with you, as some chimps can and so on, you instantly feel that you can get inside its head. But if it can't communicate with you, you're stuck with, you know, interpreting things and anthropomorphizing. And if it can't tell you that it doesn't want to die, then you can ignore that quite carefully. And this is if it's got any such thought as it doesn't want to die, which I suspect it hasn't. But there was something that really, really got to me, which is there is some research. This was mentioned in the programme, so do forgive me for repeating it if you have heard it. But there was some research done in Cambridge with some cows where they put the cows into two categories. And they get... they've got a chute to walk down. At the front of the chute, there's a gate, and at the back of the chute, there's a treat. I'm not sure what a cow treat is, but there's a treat at the end. And half the group, the control group, could press a button to release the gate, but it wouldn't actually have any effect on the gate. And the gate would come up randomly, and when it would come up, they'd go down the bottom, they'd get their treat, not show any sign of any behaviour change at all. The second group could control the opening of the gate by pressing the button, and they would then be able to get to the treat at a time of their choosing. So you can imagine they pressed that button an awful lot and they kept going to get the treat. But the thing that really got to me, that when they got to the treat and realised that they were controlling this process, they did what I think of as a sort of cow dance. They kicked and they jigged and they showed signs of, however you want to look at it, some engagement with having control, which looks a lot to us like a sign of pleasure. And when I thought a cow gets more fun out of its life than just chomping on some grass, which, you know, doesn't count for much, I guess, but when it could take a pleasure in achieving something or controlling something or having more access to treats, it's like, oh, okay, that cow does actually get something out of being alive that I wasn't adding into my calculus of cow pleasure. That upset me.
Yeah, I remember in the show you saying that, and it reminds me of, I mean, we have a little cocker spaniel called Chess, and he's a little terror. But also, you know, he has those sort of responses. As soon as he hears his bowl being scraped, then he'll start spinning around and barking and getting really excited. And it's all things like that. You know, if he sees that you've got a treat in your hand, he'll sit down and his ears will prick up and he'll start trying to give you his paw. And that's one of the main reasons why people love dogs, because they do react like that. Yeah. And, you know, it's almost like a human reaction, isn't it? Excitement. And perhaps if more people, and you're starting to make me question things now, Joe, as well, but perhaps if more people knew that cows could react like that. I think we already sort of know that pigs react like that. Yeah. I've seen footage of pigs getting really excited at feeding time and so forth. Hasn't so far stopped me from eating pork products, but... like I said at the start, the more I think about this, the more I'm going to struggle with it a little bit, I think, over time. It'd probably take a little while to properly sink in, but yeah, I think I'm going to struggle a bit more in the future, having listened to the programme and having thought about it. Either that, or in a few weeks or a few months, it'll sort of fade in my memory. I think that's probably more likely.
Mark, you can always remind yourself and give yourself a moral kick.
Yeah. During the show, did anything else? Because I don't think you mentioned it, but I just wondered during your research, did anything come up about kind of animal rights in general, in terms of, you know, like animal testing and stuff like that? Or would you consider that to occupy a slightly different moral framework?
I think animal testing, I mean, it has some overlap, but I suppose when we think about animal testing, we're generally thinking about animal suffering, and I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with that. But then, of course, you've got a different set of things to weigh morally, haven't you, which is the benefit to humans of that research versus the pain caused to the animal. I mean, I think that isn't something we looked at all, and I think it does raise quite interesting questions along the same territory of why we think this line is important between humans and non-human animals. and why we think it's okay for non-human animals to suffer for the sake of humans. And then I suppose immediately the thought comes to mind, well, I don't like the idea in principle, but what if it was someone close to me who's going to benefit from this research? And that's the thing with being human, I suppose. We don't see these things purely in isolation. We do see them in terms of the humans around us and the people we care for. And we use a different set of criteria. And I think, although it's quite hard when you get down to it to find a comfortable line between humans and non-human animals, that doesn't alter the fact for a second that we are always going to care for our families and our friends more than we're ever going to care for a pig we don't know. I mean, I don't think there's any question there. Different moral territory, didn't go into it, but maybe one for the future.
Yeah, because, I mean, it sort of strikes me, just to maybe close on this one, that there's a much stronger moral argument for testing medical cures on animals than there is on killing them and eating their flesh, really, isn't there? Because at least the kind of the utilitarian aspect of this, about, you know, the most benefit derived from the death of the animal, if you can find a cure for Alzheimer's or, you know, a cure for some horrible diseases or something that will lessen human suffering, there's a much stronger argument for that. And yet it seems like, you know, the ethics of meat eating isn't on the agenda at all, whereas the ethics of animal testing usually is on the agenda, and I've seen that debated numerous times.
No, that's a very interesting point that you make, and I think we display that inconsistency all the time in the way we behave, and I think those debates get politicised and they get picked up by the media and talked about in certain ways. Interesting, very interesting point, and I think I'm going to have to go away and rethink how I feel about animal testing now. Thanks, Mark.
As if you didn't have enough to think about with respect to animals, Joe. Thanks very much for your time tonight, Joe.
It's been great
to speak to you. That's Joe Fidgin, who is a journalist and a presenter of Analysis on Radio 4. Now we're going to move on to probably slightly less contentious subject, although who knows. I'm delighted to be joined by the comedian Wendy Wason. Hi, Wendy.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Mark. How are you?
Good. And we were going to talk about something that you mentioned to me that you're writing a show about at the moment, about the different roles that you fulfil in your life and,
yeah,
and whether or how much room there is left for the real you, in quotes, at the end of it all. Do you want to maybe just outline what you're thinking on this?
Well, basically, I'm a comedian. Obviously, that's one role. But I'm also a mother of three. I'm a wife. I'm a daughter. I'm a sister. I'm a sister-in-law. I'm a daughter-in-law. And there's lots of... I do stuff at the school. I'm a school governor. So there's loads of different roles that I do. And I find... Sometimes when I was 20, I knew everything about everything, like all 20-year-olds, and my opinion was the final say in everything. But now when people ask me things, I kind of have to think, what do I think about that? Because at the end of all these roles, sometimes there's very little time, and there's just not much left for me at the end of it.
Hmm. And what do you think of as the you at the end of it all, then? I mean, what's the neutral you that isn't fulfilling any of these roles? Is it just when you're sitting down watching the television, or...?
Well, I don't know. The neutral me used to be really busy and out doing stuff, and I quite like walking, you know, I do yoga for me, and I like being buried in a book. But I was laughing because a friend of mine, someone was telling me, but have you heard about Second Life?
Yeah, you see, I'm probably a bit old for that stuff,
but
I have heard of it.
The concept of Second Life is you can create this other life for yourself on the internet, and you can be Mark the property mogul, and you have, you know, you have a whole different life, and you can be a multimillionaire with, like, a wife and a mistress and a flash car. You can create all that for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually earn money on Second Life, and you can be a completely different person to who you are. And I was listening to it thinking, that sounds exhausting. I think if I created a Second Life, it would pretty much be me just lying in a dark room, sleeping for 50% of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I said I'm a bit too... I mean, I'm 41, and I think I used to play computer games when I was younger.
Really?
It was things like Jet Set Willy and Chucky Egg. And
Chucky Egg.
Yeah.
You used to have to load it before dinner and then go and have your tea.
What, because it took so long to load,
you mean? It took so long on the BBC computer.
Yeah. I had ZX Spectrum at first, and then I moved on to an Acorn Electron. And then later on, I played... slightly more substantial games, like there's a game called Civilization you could get for the PC, where you sort of, you started out as a little caravan and you then built up like a little village, became a town, and then you build more towns and you'd end up taking over the world, and you could, you know, go to the moon or launch nuclear strikes on other people. It's more fun to nuke other cities, actually, from other civilizations. But
it's more fun to nuke other cities than American foreign policy right there.
Yeah, I'm just, that's the way they made the game. I think it was made by an American, actually.
But, how strange. I don't know how it made that leap.
Yeah, but I don't know. I find these more modern games a bit frightening and a bit too difficult to get my head into. I can sort of understand why something like Grand Theft Auto, I've not played it, but I've seen, you know, there's a lot of scope. You can go in, you can do all sorts of stuff. But I have to say, with those sort of games where you can go in and you can do things like you were saying there, you can be a property mogul and so on and so forth. I remember seeing this game, Farmville, I think it was called, and you could create a farm and you could grow, you know, you could grow vegetables and you could tend animals. And this is the problem. I am so old now that I just think, well, why don't you just get an allotment and just start growing actual vegetables?
Yeah. And the health benefits of that are amazing, because even now, if you go for a health checkup, you're in your 40s, I had my over 40 health checkup, and they were, do you do gardening, is one of the questions for your possible, you know, your link to heart disease, because it's so relaxing and so calming that it has health benefits.
Mm.
So you'd be much, but yeah, it's much more worthwhile actually growing a garden.
Yeah, well, you see, that's what I've done. You see, but we've moved to the country, and I've got myself a raised bed, so not an allotment. I'm not going 3 miles away from my house. I
but
want it in my back
at
garden.
You with the lingo, a raised bed. Okay. I'm not even entirely sure what that is.
No, well, I didn't do it actually. We bought it, and the house already had a raised. It's about a metre high, you know, and it's raised up, so there's nice deep soil, and you can plant your plants. I've done quite well this year, although I did have one of my neighbours to help me out. But slightly digressed from the original point here, actually.
No, that's good. I always digress from every topic. This is how my stand up starts off. I think today I'm going to discuss politics. Before you know where I am, I'm on stage chatting away about someone's mum.
But so we were talking about roles. I mean, I wrote down a list of the different roles that I've
fulfilled. You've got lots of different roles as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've written down husband, father, son, brother, software engineer, which is my day job, company director, I sort of part own a company, political commentator, which is something I do, writer, I write a blog and I've written for online publications, radio show host, what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned daughter-in-law. I'm a son-in-law as well, and actually there's probably loads of other roles I've not even thought about. I mean, one thing that interests me about all of this is, do you think you're different people in those roles? Do you think your personality modifies, even subtly, in those different roles?
Yes,
or do you think you don't think you're exactly the same person in each of those roles?
I think there's essence of me in all the things. I mean, I'm quite sort of, it's really funny, because I had a long conversation with my husband about this morning, because he will always say to me, you need to do more stuff for yourself and make time for yourself. And I say, you don't understand how rewarding I find it doing stuff for other people. He's kind of like, my husband would if he thought about his ideal day, it would be him reading the papers with a pint in a pub and just completely pleasing himself, whereas I quite like, you know, taking the kids for lunch, or I get just as much from that as I do from my own time on my own. Does that make sense?
It does. I'd probably be a bit more towards your husband. Well, maybe it's a male-female thing, I don't know. I mean, I don't consider myself to be selfish in that respect, but I do quite value alone time. I'm not one of these people who tends to get lonely. If I've got some time to myself, I'll either catch up on some stuff I've been wanting to watch, or do some reading, or do some writing. Mm-hmm. I'll find things to fill the time, and I don't particularly worry about having a few hours to myself. I mean, I have an 18-month-old son now, and he's a little delight, but getting a couple of hours here or there is obviously, you know, a kind of a rare thing these days.
Yeah.
So when I do get those times, and if you've got three children, I'm sure you can empathise with that. But it sounds like you quite like all of that side of stuff.
Here's the weird thing about it, though. I've got so many different roles, and I do voiceovers as well, and I do because I write comedy and I perform stand-up. I quite like the fact that I think I'm a better comic now that I've got three children and other things to think about than I was prior to that. And I'm a better actor because I bring more to it than I had before, and I've got a more reasoned opinion on all kinds of areas.
It's not just the extra material it gives you.
Oh, yes, that too. But then I had a journalist last week saying to me, don't you think, you talk about your children on stage quite a lot, don't you think they deserve their privacy?
Mm.
And it really sort of, I kind of thought, and I thought long and hard about it, and then I took my daughter to a gig last week in Edinburgh, and she stayed with me in the hotel, and I said, do you want to come to the gig? And she said, no, I'd like to order room service and watch television. And I thought, okay. And I said, and she said, Mummy, you do have quite a cool job. And I said, do you think? And she said, yeah, you've got quite a cool job. And I said, do you think you'd like to be a stand-up? And she said, no, I think I'd like to be able to afford to buy all the things that you consider perks.
Right.
And I thought, right, you just kissed goodbye to your privacy, young lady. After that comment, you're not getting any privacy.
So in terms of, how do you think that your personality changes in the different roles? I mean, what do you think of the two extreme Wendy's? You know, which of those two roles would you pick at kind of the far ends? You know, the role you mentioned about school governor, do you have to be particularly formal and remembering all the rules about that?
Well, yeah, school governor is an interesting one because I wanted to be involved in that and to find a bit more about the kids. I want to be aware of what's going on in my children's lives. And my mum was a working mum and didn't really have time to sort of commit to stuff in the school. And I kind of think if you prioritise and make time, you can get most things. I mean, I do feel like I'm the master of time management. And I think I can fit much more in now than I did in my 20s because I do plan everything out. But school governance is much more formal. But I do find myself in situations, and I have to have a word with myself when I think, oh, it's getting a bit heavy here. I'll lighten it by saying something hilarious. And it's often inappropriate in certain situations. What I should do is just shut my mouth and get on with it. In fact, I did it the other week there. I went to play basketball in the local sports hall, because I used to play basketball a lot when I was a student. Mm. And I went and turned up, and it said mixed basketball, but it was just guys. Mm. And I thought, well, I'm not going to not play, because I want a game of basketball. And they were getting quite sort of rough, you know. At first they were very nice to me, and then of course I started shooting a few hoops, and boys didn't like that so much. So they were just a little bit, you know, more contact than they were initially.
Hmm.
And this guy said, sorry, I'm marking you, I just keep trying not to hit you. And I said, thinking I was hilarious, oh, I bet you say that to all the ladies. And it was just one of those things where it was just the wrong time.
Hmm.
The whole team just looked at me and I thought, oh no, I'm not at work now. You can't make domestic violence jokes to people you don't know.
Well, it's a nice breaker, isn't it? I've sort of been wondering, I guess everyone to a certain extent has this sort of thing, don't they, where they have different roles that they have to fulfil and perhaps slightly different, you know, aspects of their personality that they have to show in the different roles that they have. And I was thinking about this. I have met a few people in my time who kind of claim not to be like that. And, you know, they tend to be the sort of people who tell it like it is. You know, I'm a straight talker. Uh-huh. And actually, usually those people are crashing bores, I think is the euphemism, and
yeah,
they're just kind of bigots. So, in a way, this sort of having the different roles to play and fulfil is kind of, it's part of human nature, isn't it? I mean, the way I interact with my son is obviously going to be different to the way that I interact with my wife.
Yeah.
Occasionally I might, you know, do the same silly voices that I do with my son, with my wife, or I might make up slightly different lyrics to the Postman Pat song because, you know, for my wife's amusement and my own amusement, because I have to say he seems incredibly incompetent at his job because he's always running late and yet apparently he's the best and,
well, yeah,
you know, mission accomplished.
But then, you know, as a reflection on society, how many times do you work with someone you think, how do you have your job? You're so poor at your job. How do you, like, I've had a builder's round tonight and I think, my God, how do you guys work? Maybe he's just a reflection of what's going on.
Maybe. I mean, are you familiar with the concept of the Peter Principle?
The Peter Principle, I'm
yeah,
not.
Well, it's something I heard about a while ago, and I thought it was actually just a kind of glib platitude that didn't really mean anything. The essence of it is that you're promoted to your level of incompetence, and that's the catchphrase.
Wow.
But it's much more involved than that, because that just sounds like, oh, yeah, well, you know, people who are promoted are incompetent. But actually, it's more specific than that. It's that, imagine there's a company and there are, say, 7 different levels within that company, and you start at the bottom rung and you get promoted. You're really good at role number 1, so you get promoted to number 2. You're really good at that, you get promoted to number 3. You're really good at that, you get promoted to number 4. You're not very good at number 4, but you've already been promoted to number 4. So what happens? Well, you won't get promoted to number 5 because you're rubbish at number 4, but people generally don't get demoted. That's not really something that we do in our society. I suppose it does happen occasionally, but what's far more likely is you'll just get left at level four. So you've been promoted to your level of incompetence. You were great as a level three, but you're at a level four. You're not going to go up, and you're not probably going to go down. So you're just stuck there. So I think that is why so many jobs that people do aren't done that well, because the people who are fulfilling the roles, it's usually kind of management roles. It's usually when the nature of the job changes. So, you know, you were a doer and suddenly you become a people manager. Yeah. You're rubbish at people management, but you're not going to get demoted. You're not going to get promoted. So you just stay managing people. And I'm sure most people listening, probably all people listening, will have been in a job or maybe multiple jobs where their manager was not a people person. Yeah. And that's part of the reason why.
I find that's so interesting, and it also makes perfect sense. I kind of find that with, like, I was looking at sort of comedy. I mean, obviously I love comedy. I'm a comic, but I'm also a comedy fan. And I find it bizarre when I look at comedians who I really respect. And I kind of likened it, I explained to my mother, because my mother is a nurse.
Hmm.
And we were talking about it today, and she's not a nurse, she's a lecturer.
Hmm.
She started off as a staff nurse and was promoted to sister, and then was really good at that, and then... Hmm. The more promotions, and my mom's great at putting people at their ease and chatting away, and she's very knowledgeable in her profession. But with each promotion, she was getting further and further away from patients.
Yeah.
And then she found herself in a management role and then hated her job.
Hmm.
And you can't, and then she said, you know, she's this part of her that would love to go back on a ward, but then it would look like it was a return, it was a sort of step back for her. Whereas, you know, is that sort of thing going on?
Yeah.
How do you say, do you know what, I'm just not happy in this job, I'd rather take the smaller salary and be doing what I love.
Mm.
And I find that with lots of comics as well, comedians who work in a small room, because I feel comedy is about connecting with people and talking to people. And
yeah.
And it's extraordinary, you go up and down the country and around the world, and everyone has the same hopes and fears and the same worries and same, you know, moments of joy. But you connect with people, and then you become a very successful comic, and you're doing stadium tours. And your material starts to be about, you know, being on an aeroplane or things that you notice things about the service in a 5-star restaurant that your audience probably aren't going to connect with, because they're not living that life that you are.
Yeah, and I think there was an episode of The Simpsons where Krusty the Clown decides to go back to, go back to his roots and try and do stand-up, and he says something like, don't you hate it when your butler's 30 seconds late and the whole crowd are just, like, booing and throwing things at him? Because obviously he's completely out of touch. It's interesting you say that, though, because the kind of... I don't know whether most comedians who are kind of working the circuit and working relatively small or medium-sized rooms do aspire to this, but... I guess the way the general public generally see comedians are, they're on panel shows or they get their own show on television. That almost seems to be the pinnacle. And yet, that's precisely where you don't have that connection with the audience.
I can't imagine anything duller than doing a panel show.
Yeah.
And also, you look at it, I mean, obviously, if I get, like, occasionally I get offered them and I think, oh, shall I? But that's my priority at the minute, is being at home with the children. And if I was doing panel shows and... up and down, you know, doing all that kind of stuff where you're working late into the night, I wouldn't be at home for bedtime, and I wouldn't bath my son, you know, get to bath the kids. And I find also the moments that I learn more about the kids when we're sitting having dinner just chatting, and one of them will say, I don't like peas today, and I don't like peas, and you have that weird conversation that you can't have if you're rushing out the door.
Yeah.
And that's going to be past, you know, that they're going to be, my two eldest are now at high school, and my 4-year-old's going to be off, you know, in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And I could be sat in a panel show, or I can be discussing peace, and I know what I'd rather be doing.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the thing that we were talking about with the, the kind of the promotion thing, I mean, there is another way to do that, which, as I mentioned earlier on, I'm also a software engineer, my day job. And I know there was a big push a few years ago, 5 or 10 years ago, to start trying to structure things in companies so that there was more than one path. So instead of it just being, you know, you're a junior code monkey, and then you're a more senior code monkey, and then you're a senior code monkey, and then after that you have to be promoted into management. There's nowhere else to go. To try and have this kind of guru track where you could end up earning as much as a manager, or perhaps even more, but you stay doing
what
Soft,
you're doing.
Software development, yeah. You're just doing it at a higher level and perhaps mentoring people, but not necessarily being the, you know, line manager or anything.
I think we need to do more of mentoring in the workplace. I think it's such an extraordinary thing to do. Not in the same way that doing something for someone else gives me immense pleasure, that kind of thing, that the sharing knowledge with other people is rewarding for them and for you.
Yeah.
And I've just written a series of books for the kids, but I mean, I've not got a publisher yet, so if anyone, basically, my if anyone wants to publish my books, give us a shout. I have written a book, I've written three books that my eldest is very bright, and my younger boy is still very bright. My 11-year-old is bright, but he doesn't feel as bright as her because she's 2 years older than him, so everything he's coming to learn, she knows.
Yeah.
So he doesn't get to be the sort of wobbly-headed bright one because she's already ahead of him.
Yeah.
And she's quite happy to sit down and learn her spellings and go through things by rote. But he gets bored by that. So what I did was I wrote stories for the youngest one with all my middle son's key stage two spelling words in them.
Yeah.
So basically he's revising while reading to his little brother, but he doesn't know he's revising. He's just getting to feel like the bright one. And there's an effect that they've published recently called the sibling spillover effect. Have you heard about this?
No.
Basically, your siblings, the elder ones coach the younger ones, and the younger children hit their targets ahead of schedule because they've got so much more stimulation and information coming to them in a easily digestible way from their elder siblings.
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I at the moment we have one son, but I was the eldest of three sons, and so I didn't experience that directly, but the more I think about it, I think about my younger brothers. I could certainly see how they probably did pick things up from me earlier than I would have done. I do remember one of my best friends when I was about 8 or 9 years old. He had an older sister. She was probably 11 or 12 when we were about 8 or 9. And so that meant that he knew all about like pop music and he knew loads of things that I didn't know. And actually, he was a bit younger than me. And so I used to kind of pick that stuff up from him via osmosis that he was picking up from his sister. So there's probably even a second order effect in that
and
respect.
And also, you will have the confidence of knowing more than your brothers. So what that does to the first... I think birth order is much more... You know how they sort of say, you know, what affects children? And I read quite a lot about it. It's a great book. You've got a son at the minute.
Yeah.
Called Bringing Up Boys by Steve Biddulph.
Okay.
And it's a great book about bringing up boys because there's so many things that little boys do that you kind of understand what, you know. I had a girl first and I understand what she's going through and she'll tell me everything. And my boys just, they eventually tell me stuff, but I have to be colouring in with them or doing a distraction tactic before they'll start talking about their feelings.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've brought them up differently, but, I always think the birth order is very important as well, because where you sit in the family it defines quite a lot about yourself as well. And if you're the firstborn, we tend to be, I'm a firstborn as well, you tend to be sort of a little bit more confident and assured in who you are because you've done everything first.
See, that's interesting, because I am, in the fact I'm sitting here hosting a radio show, shows I have a certain level of confidence, but I've done lots of other stuff as well. I mean, I'm regularly on radio, I've done TV stuff, I've done amateur dramatics as well, and although I get a bit nervous, I've never really had that much of an issue with nerves. I just kind of step up and get on with it. And maybe that's part of it. Maybe that's because I was the eldest child and I'm the one who had to break the barriers down first. I remember one thing I was quite irritated about when I was a child. My mum might be listening to this, actually. So, well,
hi, Mum. Hi, Mark's mum.
Hi, Mum. When I was a kid, I had to be in bed by 9 o'clock, I think right up until I was about 16. And then I finally managed to break that barrier. And within about 6 months, a brother who was 2 years younger than me was suddenly allowed to stay up till 11 o'clock at night. And within about a year, the one who's 4.5 years younger than me was allowed to stay up really late. And that really irritated me because it felt like, you know, but I can understand from my parents' perspective that, you know, they'd had enough battles with me.
My husband's really fair about that because I'll say, oh, you know, it's only 2 years between them. And he says, no, the eldest should get a little bit more for a little bit longer. And he's really good because he was the youngest brother.
Ah.
So he knows the importance of that. But then also, I feel like when I look at, I think the way parents speak to older children is really important. I mean, as I say, this is me with my mum hat on, and I think being the mother of a daughter is another role to being the mother of a son. That's, I think they're, you know, they're similar but different. But I am. What was I talking about there? I lost my thread.
You're talking about the role that you...
Oh, yeah, the way I speak to... The way you speak to your older children.
Yeah.
Like, I speak to Isabella. Like, she's... You know, I'll say, come on, don't do that. Just give him that. Stop him crying. Hmm. Give the four-year-old that. But when Bella was 4 years old, I spoke to her like she was 19 because she had a little brother who was 2 years younger. So I was bringing up... And she was still a toddler, but I was expecting the behaviour of an older child from her. And she stepped up because... That's what you do.
That's very interesting, isn't it? That it's almost like, you know, faking it to make it. They become the role that you bestow upon them by the way that you treat them.
Yeah.
I'll have to remember that with my son. He, like I say, he's 18 months at the moment. And obviously he's kind of running around and, you know, causing chaos. It is a fun age. He's just getting to the point now where, in fact, he said his first two-syllable word yesterday.
Oh, what did he say?
Garden. In relation to In the Night Garden. Which I must have watched about 200 episodes of that with him kind of once a night for about the first 7 or 8 months. But he just never seemed that bothered about it, and he would always be going off doing other stuff. And just in about the last week, put it on again, because I thought maybe he's ready for this now, and he's absolutely transfixed. He's just standing there staring at the screen. He's pointing at the screen saying, "Garden." And as soon as the characters started coming out, he knew they all were. He was pointing at Iggle Piggle saying pig, and then he was pointing at Upsy Daisy saying days, and he was pointing at Macapaca saying pack. So all of this stuff, even when he was only 6 months old, must have all been going in.
It's all going in.
And it's all just coming out again now. So I'm thinking, like, what have we said in front of him?
Oh, that'll come out as well.
Don't tell me that, Wendy.
That's my top tip for long-haul flights with young children. Is to not let them watch their favourite programmes for like the week before you fly, and then maybe half an hour into the flight, get it up on the iPad and watch them not move a muscle.
That sounds like an excellent tip. I will remember that, Wendy. It's been great having you on.
Thank you for having me. No, sorry, we went around the houses there. Did we even cover what we were supposed to cover?
I think we covered it a bit, but I'm quite happy to go wherever the discussion takes us when we're talking about stuff like this. So that's great. Thanks so much, Wendy. It'd be great to have you back on again at some point.
Thank you so much, Mark. Have a good night.
Good stuff, and you. Okay, so thanks very much for listening. I've been Mark Thompson. You've been listening to the Music Mill FM. I'll be back next week with more guests and more discussions about topical stuff and other stuff as well.